All right, so let's dive into this case.
Okay.
It's basically like ripped straight from today's headlines, you know.
Yeah.
A long-term contract gone wrong in a world gone crazy.
Uh-huh.
We're talking Aluminum Co. of America v. Essex Group.
Okay.
A case that still sends shivers down the spines of contract lawyers everywhere.
Well, what's fascinating about this is it throws into question the very foundation of contract law. You know, the idea of pacta sunt servanda,
right,
agreements must be kept.
Right.
But what happens when keeping your word means financial ruin?
Exactly. And that's the crux of this case. You've got Alcoa, this industrial giant,
right,
signing a 21-year contract with Essex Group back in 1967 to turn alumina into aluminum.
Yeah.
Seems like a pretty standard deal at the time.
Yeah. The contract included a complex pricing formula.
Okay.
Tied in part to the wholesale price index.
Okay.
The WPI. To account for, you know, potential increases in production costs, especially energy.
Makes sense. Protect yourself from inflation.
Seems reasonable, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Protect yourself from inflation.
So where did things go off the rails?
Well, fast forward to 1973.
Okay.
OPEC oil embargo hits, energy prices explode, and the WPI, it doesn't budge.
Damn.
Alcoa is suddenly staring down the barrel of massive losses.
Yeah.
We're talking $75 million because the contract price is nowhere near covering their actual production costs.
Ouch. That's not just a bad quarter. That's an existential threat.
Right.
So what does Alcoa do? Take it on the chin.
Not a chance. They sue Essex, arguing for reformation of the contract.
Okay.
Basically, they're asking the court to rewrite the deal because, let's face it, the original agreement had become completely unworkable.
Well, hold on. Asking a court to actually rewrite a contract, isn't that like legal heresy?
It's a big deal. And that's what makes this case so important.
Okay.
Alcoa argued that the original contract was based on a mutual mistake.
Okay.
Both parties assumed the WPI would accurately reflect energy costs.
Right.
Which simply wasn't the case after the oil crisis.
So it wasn't just a case of buyer's remorse. This wasn't about Alcoa wanting a better deal after the fact.
Exactly. The court really drilled down on this point, distinguishing between a simple miscalculation and a fundamental misunderstanding about how the pricing mechanism would work in an unprecedented situation.
Okay. I'm seeing how this is getting more complex than a typical contract dispute.
Right.
What were the other legal arguments at play?
Well, Alcoa also brought up breach of an oral amendment.
Okay.
But that's a whole other can of worms. More importantly, they sought a declaratory judgment.
Okay, time out. Declaratory judgment. Mm. What exactly does that mean in plain English?
It's basically asking the court to clarify the party's rights and obligations under the contract. Like, hey, can we just walk away from this whole thing now that it's gone haywire?
Right.
Of course Essex wasn't having it. They countersued Alcoa for damages, claiming Alcoa wasn't holding up their end of the bargain by delivering the aluminum.
Gotcha. So you've got this legal showdown brewing, two corporate titans battling it over a contract that's imploding.
Yeah.
High stakes legal drama.
Yeah.
So what were the big legal issues that the court had to grapple with?
The core question was whether a court could or even should modify a contract when unforeseen events essentially rip the guts out of its economic purpose.
Yeah.
This case put the principle of pacta sunt servanda through the ringer.
Right. But as we've said, a deal's a deal only goes so far when the deal itself has become totally unreasonable.
Right. And to sort this out, the court had to consider some key legal doctrines, mutual mistake, impracticability, and frustration of purpose.
Uh-huh.
These are all related,
okay,
but have distinct nuances that make this case so fascinating for contract law.
All right. Let's break those down one by one.
Mm.
Mutual mistake. We touched on that. What was the court's take?
The court acknowledged that both Alcoa and Essex messed up by assuming the WPI would accurately track energy costs.
Right.
But they were very clear this wasn't a simple math error. It was a fundamental misunderstanding about how the WPI would operate in a world turned upside down by the oil embargo.
So the court was saying, hey, this isn't just Alcoa trying to weasel out of a bad deal.
Right.
This was a real screw up that neither party could have anticipated.
Precisely. The court highlighted the extreme gap between the contract price and Alcoa's actual costs.
Right.
It wasn't just a slight miscalculation. It was like the whole foundation of their pricing agreement had collapsed.
Okay. So that's mutual mistake.
Right.
Let's move on to the next legal concept. Impracticability.
Okay.
What's the deal with that one?
Think of the OPEC oil embargo as a textbook example of an unforeseen event that made fulfilling the contract either commercially impossible or at the very least impossibly unfair.
So Alcoa's argument is we're being forced to produce aluminum at a huge loss.
Right.
Which was never part of the original agreement.
Exactly. And the court actually agreed, stating that this dramatic increase in energy costs wasn't just a typical business risk that Alcoa had assumed.
Right.
It was a fundamental shift in the economic landscape, a change to the basic assumptions
right.
on which the entire contract rested.
Alcoa is making a pretty strong case so far.
Uh-huh.
What about frustration of purpose? Did that factor into the court's decision?
It did. The court found that the sky-high energy costs basically undermined the central purpose of the contract, which was a fair exchange of value between the parties.
Yeah.
Alcoa was essentially being forced to subsidize Essex's aluminum, which was never the intent.
So we've got three strong legal arguments in Alcoa's favor. Mutual mistake, impracticability, and frustration of purpose.
Right.
What did the court actually decide? Did they just tear up the contract and call it a day?
That's where things get really interesting.
Okay.
Instead of voiding the contract completely, they opted to reform it.
Okay.
They used their equitable powers to adjust the pricing formula so it better reflected Alcoa's actual costs.
Okay, wait, back up. Reform the contract. Why not just throw the whole thing out?
The court's reasoning was that completely voiding the contract would send shockwaves through the business world.
Oh, wow.
If courts started tossing out contracts every time something unexpected happened, it would create chaos and undermine the stability of long-term agreements.
Right. So they wanted to acknowledge that things had gone very wrong, but also preserve the basic agreement between the parties whenever possible.
Right. It was a delicate balancing act.
Yeah.
Upholding the sanctity of contracts while recognizing that extreme situations sometimes require extreme solutions.
So how did the court actually go about reforming this contract? Did they just pull numbers out of a hat?
Not at all. They had to come up with a fair and reasonable solution, considering industry standards, expert testimony, and the party's original intentions.
Yeah.
The goal was to create a pricing mechanism that reflected the real costs involved.
Right.
Without unfairly benefiting either party.
Let me get this straight. They considered the impact of the energy crisis, the specifics of the original contract, and the broader implications for contract law in general.
Yeah.
That's a lot to juggle.
It was a landmark decision, and not just about Alcoa and Essex.
Right.
This case set a precedent for how courts should handle similar situations in the future.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But before we jump into the legacy of Alcoa v. Essex, I want to make sure I understand exactly how they reformed this contract.
Okay.
What specific changes did they make?
Well, remember that original three-part pricing formula?
Yeah.
The court zeroed in on the part tied to the WPI and essentially created a price ceiling.
Yeah.
This meant the price could still fluctuate with the WPI, but it couldn't go above a certain level,
right,
protecting Alcoa from catastrophic losses.
So they built in a safety net, preventing Alcoa from getting completely crushed by these runaway energy costs.
Exactly. But they didn't completely shield Alcoa from risk. The price could still fluctuate within certain bounds, reflecting the idea that businesses need to accept some level of risk in long-term agreements.
That's interesting. It seems like the court was walking a tightrope here, trying to be fair to both sides.
Yeah.
If they'd completely insulated Alcoa, wouldn't that have been unfair to Essex?
Absolutely. They were striving for a balanced solution, acknowledging that the original contract had become fundamentally unfair.
Yeah.
Due to circumstances no one could have foreseen.
This is fascinating stuff, but I have to admit my head is spinning a little bit with all these legal concepts.
Yeah.
What's the big takeaway here? What should lawyers and businesses learn from Alcoa v. Essex?
The most important takeaway is this. Even the most meticulously crafted contracts can be vulnerable to the unexpected.
Right.
The world throws curveballs, and sometimes even the best laid plans go awry.
Okay, so should we all just give up on long-term contracts,
throw
our hands up, and say, what's the point if everything can change anyway?
Not at all. This case actually provides valuable guidance on how to make contracts more robust and adaptable.
Okay.
It highlights the importance of anticipating potential risks, building in flexibility.
Yeah.
And considering what might happen if the unexpected occurs.
So practical advice, not just theoretical, legal mumbo jumbo.
Right.
I like it. Can you give me some specific examples? What are some ways to build in that flexibility you're talking about?
One common approach is to include what's called a force majeure clause.
Okay.
These clauses essentially say that if certain extraordinary events occur, things like natural disasters, wars, or, well, massive energy crises, the parties can be excused from performing their obligations under the contract.
So it's like a get-out-of-jail-free card for extreme situations.
Kind of, but it's important to note that force majeure clauses are usually very specific.
Okay.
They're not a catch-all excuse for any minor inconvenience.
Right.
They're meant for truly exceptional circumstances that were completely unforeseen and outside the party's control.
Okay, so force majeure is one tool in the toolbox.
Right.
What else can we do?
Another option is to include price adjustment mechanisms.
Okay.
These can be as simple as a periodic review of the contract price.
Okay.
Or more sophisticated, like using a different index that better tracks relevant costs.
Right. So learning from Alcoa's mistake and making sure your chosen index actually reflects the reality of the market.
Exactly. You can also build in renegotiation clauses.
Okay.
Which require the parties to come back to the table and try to hammer out a new deal.
Right.
If certain trigger events occur.
That sounds like a good way to encourage open communication and hopefully avoid ending up in a courtroom brawl.
Right.
Any other tips?
One more that's really important. Make sure your contract is crystal clear about which party bears the risk of certain events.
Okay.
You don't want to end up in a situation where everyone's pointing fingers,
yeah,
claiming they never agreed to take on a particular risk.
Right. So clear communication, careful planning, and maybe a little bit of fortune telling.
Well, we can't predict the future perfectly, but we can at least try to anticipate potential challenges and build in mechanisms to address them.
This has been incredibly helpful. But before we move on to the legacy of Alcoa v. Essex, I want to loop back to something you said earlier.
Okay.
You mentioned the court used its equitable powers to reform the contract.
Right.
Can you break that down for me? Equity always sounds so vague in legal discussions.
You're right. It can be a bit fuzzy. Essentially, equity in law refers to a set of principles and remedies that go beyond strict legal rules.
Okay.
Courts can use their equitable powers to achieve a just and fair outcome,
right,
even if it means bending or modifying the literal letter of the law.
Okay, so in this case, the court wasn't just robotically applying a rigid set of rules.
Right.
They were trying to find a solution that was fair and reasonable given the unique circumstances of this situation.
Exactly. They recognized that sticking to the strict terms of the contract would lead to a deeply unfair outcome, so they used their equitable powers to create a more just solution.
So Alcoa v. Essex reminds us that the law isn't always black and white. Sometimes you need some flexibility and creativity to achieve a truly just result.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
And on that note, we've reached the end of part one of our deep dive into Alcoa v. Essex. Join us next time as we explore the lasting impact of this landmark case and what it means for contract law today.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Aluminum Co. of America v. Essex Group.
Last time we left off with the court's decision to reform the contract using its equitable powers.
Right.
A pretty bold move considering the whole idea of pacta sunt servanda, right?
Right. The principle that agreements must be kept. But as we discussed, this case presented a real dilemma, a clash between principle and practicality.
Exactly. So let's shift gears a bit and talk about the legacy of this case.
Okay.
How did Alcoa v. Essex impact contract law moving forward? Did it send everyone scrambling to rewrite their contracts?
Well, it definitely became a landmark decision.
Okay.
A real turning point in how courts approach long-term contracts, especially when unforeseen events throw a wrench into the works.
So it's not just a cautionary tale for aluminum smelters.
Not at all. The principles that came out of Alcoa v. Essex have had ripple effects across countless industries.
Uh-oh.
Think about renewable energy deals, tech supply chains, even real estate contracts.
Okay.
Any agreement that spans a significant period is vulnerable to unexpected shifts in the market technology, anything really.
Okay, so it set a precedent, but didn't it also stir up some controversy? Were people worried that this would open the floodgates for anyone trying to wiggle out of a contract just because they didn't like the outcome?
There was definitely pushback.
Yeah.
Some critics argued that this kind of judicial intervention undermines the certainty and predictability that businesses need to operate. They worried it would create a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Where parties wouldn't bother negotiating carefully if they knew they could always run to court for a do-over.
So did Alcoa v. Essex become a legal one-hit wonder? Did courts just ignore it and go back to enforcing contracts as written no matter what?
Not quite. While the case made courts more cautious about reforming contracts, it didn't make it impossible. Alcoa v. Essex established a high bar.
Right.
A really tough standard to meet for proving that circumstances had changed so drastically.
Right.
That reformation was the only fair solution.
Okay, so not a get-out-of-jail-free card, but not off the table either.
Right.
What are some of the key things that courts consider when deciding whether to reform a contract? What are the red flags they're looking for?
One of the most important factors is whether the unforeseen event was truly, and I mean truly outside the realm of what anyone could have reasonably anticipated.
Okay.
The court in Alcoa v. Essex really stressed that the OPEC oil embargo and the energy crisis that followed
right.
were not things that Alcoa could have realistically planned for.
So if you're drafting a contract, you need to think about those black swan events. The things that seem unlikely, but would have a massive impact if they actually happen.
Exactly. You also need to consider whether the contract itself allocates the risk of those unforeseen events.
Uh-huh.
If the contract clearly spells out who's responsible for what, if those risks are clearly assigned.
Right.
Courts are less likely to step in and rewrite the deal.
So clear language about risk allocation is crucial.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Another key factor is the severity of the hardship caused by the unexpected event.
Yeah.
Courts are more likely to intervene if one party is facing devastating, potentially catastrophic losses, not just a minor financial setback.
So back to that idea of equity we talked about earlier.
Right.
The court wants to ensure fairness, but they're not going to bail you out just because you made a bad deal.
Right. And finally, courts will consider whether reforming the contract would undermine the stability of the broader business world.
Okay.
They want their decisions to promote predictability, not create chaos and uncertainty.
So there's no magic formula, no easy answer. It's a complex balancing act.
It is.
Weighing the interests of the parties, the specific terms of the contract, and the broader implications for the business world.
Exactly. And that's why cases like Alcoa v. Essex continue to be so important.
Uh-huh.
They provide guidance. They offer a roadmap, helping courts navigate these tricky situations and try to achieve a just outcome.
Before we wrap up, you mentioned earlier that Alcoa v. Essex has popped up in a lot of different industries.
Right.
Can you give us some specific examples of how this case has actually influenced legal decisions in other areas?
Sure. Take the energy sector, for example.
Okay.
Long-term contracts are really common in that industry.
Yeah.
And as we've seen with all the recent price volatility, those contracts can become very risky very quickly.
Right.
Alcoa v. Essex has been cited in cases involving everything from natural gas supply agreements to renewable energy projects.
So even though the original case was about aluminum, the principles it established have had a ripple effect influencing cases across multiple industries.
Exactly. And it goes beyond energy, too.
Okay.
We've seen Alcoa v. Essex pop up in real estate disputes, technology contracts, even international trade agreements.
Wow.
Whenever you have a long-term contract and a major unforeseen event, this case is likely to come into play.
It really underscores the importance of understanding not just the specific details of a case.
Right.
But also the broader principles and legal doctrines that underlie it.
Right.
Those principles can have a huge impact shaping legal decisions in seemingly unrelated contexts.
Couldn't agree more. It's what makes studying case law so fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like peeling back the layers of a complex puzzle, uncovering the connections and implications that aren't always obvious at first glance.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today, from the specific facts of the case to the court's reasoning and the lasting impact of Alcoa v. Essex. But before we move on, I want to leave our listeners with something to ponder.
Okay. I'm intrigued. What's the final thought you want to leave us with?
We've talked about making contracts more robust and adaptable.
Right.
But I think there's a bigger question lurking beneath the surface.
Okay.
In a world that's increasingly volatile and unpredictable, how do we balance the need for certainty and stability with the reality that things can change in a heartbeat?
That's a fantastic question, and I don't think there's a simple answer.
Yeah.
It's a tension that lies at the heart of so many legal and business decisions today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How do we create agreements that are both strong enough to weather the storms and flexible enough to adapt to the changing winds?
Right.
It's a challenge that lawyers, business leaders, and policymakers are all grappling with.
And it's a challenge that isn't going away anytime soon.
Well, that's all the time we have for part two of our deep dive into Alcoa v. Essex. Join us next time as we explore the broader implications of this case for contract law in the 21st century. Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into Aluminum Co. of America v. Essex Group.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey, hasn't it?
You said it.
from a seemingly simple contract dispute to a legal earthquake that's still shaking things up today.
We've covered the facts of the case and the court's reasoning and the immediate fallout.
Right.
But now I want to zoom out and look at the bigger picture, you know?
Okay.
What does Alcoa v. Essex tell us about the challenges of navigating contracts in a world that feels increasingly volatile and unpredictable?
It's a question that's more relevant now than ever.
Yeah.
We're living in an era of breakneck technological change, globalized markets, and as we've all learned the hard way, unexpected disruptions.
Right. I mean, who could have predicted a global pandemic that would turn supply chains upside down?
Right.
Or a war in Europe with massive ripple effects on energy markets.
Exactly. These are events that would have seemed almost unthinkable just a few years ago.
Right.
Yet they have huge implications for contracts in every sector imaginable.
So what's the answer?
Well,
do we just throw in the towel on long-term contracts? Is that even realistic in today's world?
I don't think that's a practical solution or even a desirable one.
Okay.
Long-term contracts are still essential for many businesses. They provide stability, predictability, a framework for collaboration.
Okay.
But we do need to fundamentally rethink how we approach them, taking into account the lessons learned from Alcoa v. Essex.
Okay, so back to our original question.
Right.
How do we reconcile the need for certainty with the reality of a world that feels anything but certain?
It's a delicate balancing act, and there's no one-size-fits-all solution.
Right.
But I think there are a few guiding principles that can help us navigate this new landscape.
All right, I'm all ears. What are the rules of the road for drafting contracts in the age of uncertainty?
First and foremost, we need to ditch the idea that contracts are static, unchanging documents.
Okay.
The world is dynamic, fluid, constantly evolving. Our contracts need to reflect that reality.
So more flexibility, more adaptability built in from the start.
Absolutely. We need to build in mechanisms that allow contracts to evolve and adjust as circumstances change, not just hope for the best.
We talked earlier about specific tools like force majeure clauses and price adjustment mechanisms.
Yeah.
Are those still relevant today, or are they relics of a bygone era?
They're definitely still relevant.
Okay.
But we need to use them in a more nuanced and strategic way.
Okay.
Force majeure clauses, for example, should be laser focused on the specific risks of the industry and the particular deal in question.
So no more generic copy and paste clauses from a legal textbook.
Right.
We need to really think through the specific what ifs that could derail a particular contract.
Precisely. And price adjustment mechanisms need to be more sophisticated and responsive.
Okay.
We can't just rely on outdated indices that no longer reflect the realities of the market.
Yeah.
We need to consider using multiple indices or even creating custom indices that track the specific costs that are most relevant to the contract.
Okay, so more tailored clauses, more responsive mechanisms. What else should we be thinking about?
Another crucial principle is embracing collaboration and communication.
Okay.
Too often, contracts are treated as adversarial documents, setting up a win-lose dynamic between the parties.
Right, but that kind of adversarial approach can lead to those messy and expensive legal battles like we saw in Alcoa v. Essex.
Exactly. We need to shift towards a more collaborative approach.
Okay.
Where the parties see the contract as a living document, something that can be adjusted and adapted as needed to ensure a mutually beneficial outcome.
So building in regular check-ins, maybe even mediation clauses to help resolve disputes before they spiral out of control.
Exactly. And finally, I think we need to fully embrace the power of technology in contract drafting and management. There are incredible tools available now that can help us analyze risks, model different scenarios, and even automate certain aspects of contract execution.
So using technology not only to create more adaptable contracts, but also to make the whole process more efficient and transparent.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're moving towards a world where contracts are less about rigid rules.
I think so.
And more about ongoing partnerships.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. By embracing technology and a more collaborative mindset, we can create contracts that are both robust and agile, capable of navigating the complexities of the 21st century.
This has been a truly insightful deep dive, not just into a single case, but into the very nature of contracts in the modern world.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts for our listeners as they navigate this ever-changing landscape?
I think the key takeaway is this.
Okay.
Contracts are tools. and like any tool they need to be used skillfully and adapted to the task at hand.
Right.
By learning from Alcoa v. Essex, by thinking creatively and by working collaboratively,
yeah,
we can craft contracts that truly serve our needs, promote fairness, and help us navigate the uncertainties that lie ahead.
Well said. And on that note, we've reached the end of our deep dive into Alcoa v. Essex. Thanks for joining us, and remember, the only constant is change, especially in the world of contracts.